Sadly, on June 20th, 1996, Jim Ellison, the man who started the band 11 years before, committed suicide at the age of 32. Recordings done in 1995 and 1996 were released posthumously on a fourth and final album, Telecommando Americano. That has been 30 Minutes of Material Issue. A feature-length documentary on the band is scheduled to be released later this year. Don't forget, you can listen to me Friday nights at 9 here on 88.3 FM WRCT Pittsburgh in a little show I call Viva La Mock. I also want to remind you that Spack Brothers Pizza joins you in supporting WRCT Pittsburgh. Spack Brothers Pizza offers pizza, hoagies, and wings while they specialize in vegan and vegetarian alternatives. Spack Brothers Pizza uses no refined sugars in their sauce or any unbleached flour in their dough. Spack Brothers is committed to safety during the ongoing pandemic by providing online ordering and payment, as well as contact-free pickup. You can learn more about the online ordering at SpackBrothers.com. For more information, call 412-362-SPAK or visit their website at SpackBrothers.com. That's 412-362-7725 or SPAKBrothers.com. And don't forget, if you are ever interested in underwriting for WRCT, you can email pr@wrct.org for more information about promotional exchanges and other partnership opportunities.
Girl, my London girl. You've tuned in to Pandemonium, a public affairs program from WRCT Pittsburgh. The opinions expressed on this show are those of the participants and not necessarily those of WRCT or Carnegie Mellon University. Email comments or questions to WRCT Public Affairs, pa@wrct.org. And now, Pandemonium. An apocalypse is an event on a grand scale, a catastrophe that affects our lives indelibly. It is also a story that, judging from the sheer volume of them that we tell, alone and together, has a definite ending, the details of which we are rather concerned with. What is it about the current day that so often casts our focus onto apocalypse and the events that follow it? Is there a background noise of sublime terror, a raging storm, or news of permanent collapse pervading our lives, driving political conflict, justifying ever greater engineering of social order? And is this disaster specific to us, or has it always been present throughout the ages? In first seeking the center of the apocalypse, I sat down with Ben Knight, a Berlin-based filmmaker, and asked him about the movie he just made.
Okay, so it is called We're All Going to Die, and it is about people who are preparing in one way or another for catastrophe. And it kind of moves through different types of preparation. So it begins with your standard prepper type person who would be like hoarding food and maybe learning new skills and figuring out how to, you know, use radios again and rather than cell phones, and all the, yeah, just preppers, and then sort of talking about how they their kind of disappointment with the way everyone else is just carrying on their day, and they have to think about all these terrible things that are going to happen. So that's the kind of the beginning of it. Anyway, so I met a couple of preppers, and then it kind of moves into a more climate grief is a big thing now amongst a lot of people, and it has been for quite a while. And I met a couple of people in the States who went through a profound grief 20 years ago because they felt like this economic and social system was totally unsustainable. And so there was this, he's called Guy McPherson. He went and 20 years ago, he felt like, you know, this isn't going to work. No. And he went and lived on a homestead in New Mexico. He was a tenured professor, and he gave up his job and went and lived on a homestead in New Mexico and learned how to make cheese. And then he realized that there was another thing that meant that even if somehow humans prevented the burning of fossil fuels overheating the earth, because of the what he calls the aerosol dimming effect, the pollution would actually shields us from the worst heat of the sun. So even if we reduced pollution, we would be fried too. So he then realized that we're damned if we do and we're damned if we don't, and decided that he couldn't be bothered to live on a homestead anymore, and now he just lives in a normal house and gives interviews and does podcasts and things like that. And and he calls himself an educator. I mean, he's like an odd fellow, because he kind of, what was interesting about him for me was because he went through this period of profound despair and grief, and what he thought was that the futility of trying to continue. And then he came out of the other side of it and said, well, look, you know, we're all going to die, so there's nothing anyone else could do about it. So I might as well just live the best life I can the way I want to live and not worry about anything. And that's what he does now. Do I feel that daily life has given over to chaos? No, I feel like what is surprising about the current situation is that everyone is carrying on as normal to and basically shutting out the chaos as much as they can and finding ways to distract each other. I mean, there's always like an initial shock moment, as it happened when, especially if you live in Europe, when Russia just invaded Ukraine, for example. But then after a few days, and, you know, we have like thousands, hundreds of thousands of refugees, you started noticing that people were posting their Wordle scores on Twitter again, which they had been doing, you know, quite regularly up until that moment. And then there was about a week where people stopped doing it, and then they kind of put them back. So I think there's a natural human tendency to avoid chaos at all costs. If people get used to things, don't they? People get, it's surprising how quickly people get used to disaster scenarios and learn to cope. I mean, I was reading, I mean, just to get back to the same example again, but I was reading reports now of people in Kiev and how, you know, they want to open the schools again in Kiev tomorrow. They want to do online schooling again. Which is like crazy when you think about, you know, that the Russian army is 20, 25 kilometers away from the city center still. Well, first thing was that someone told me that they were going to go to Mexico anyway, and I thought, oh, that would be cool to go to Mexico. And then I thought, and then I remembered that in Mexico, it's the site of the center of the Chicxulub crater, which is the crater that was caused by the asteroid that killed all the dinosaurs 66 million years ago. And I kind of thought it would be, you know, what better place to sort of conclude the film, but at the site of a catastrophe that almost wiped out all life on Earth. And one of the five great big mass extinction events that have happened, the last one that has happened throughout in our history. And so I had this sort of vision of filming at this, because I knew there was a little monument there. There's a little memorial to the dinosaurs in this town, and it's a town on the northern coast of Yucatan, on the Yucatan, in the Yucatan Peninsula, a sort of coastal town. But the crater itself is 100 miles across, so you obviously can't see it, and it is also about a kilometer underground. And they only really found out that it was there in the 1980s. And I just thought, but then when they did find it, the little town, and it's a kind of like a, there's nothing really in the town. It's like a beach resort, but not a particularly fancy one. There are no big hotels there, but they do have a little monument to the dinosaurs, which I thought was quite poignant. So I wanted to film there, and so I did a little thing where I stood next to the monument and spoke to the camera about my feelings about why I wanted to film a scene there, and why, you know, why I saw that point as a kind of the starting point for the film, even though it was right at the end of filming. So that was one reason. The other thing was that there's a lot of Mayan people still around there, and people often think of the Mayan civilization as a civilization that collapsed. So I was quite interested in that too. So I interviewed a few Mayan people. I mean, most of the people in that region are still have Mayan heritage. So that was pretty interesting. And rather than a cycle, I would think of it as concentric circles that we're always kind of living in a space that has been created by a past disaster, that we are never really, the destruction of all the dinosaurs was what was the event that made our evolution possible, you know, I mean, it's getting a bit, like, obviously a bit esoteric now, but the idea is that we're always living in the aftermath of another disaster, and that disaster is what made our lives even possible. So I wanted kind of the end of the film, I want people to kind of make peace with the idea of apocalypse, make peace with the idea of collapse and destruction, because after all, our own lives depend on someone else's apocalypse and other creatures' extinction, you know. And so I kind of like, I see it as sort of, yeah, like we're always, in a way, our whole, we're always inside the crater of an asteroid that crushed the people that came before us, or the dinosaurs that came before us. A lot of people feel a lot of anxiety at the moment, and especially now because of the war, but also because of a lot of people feel a lot of anxiety about climate change, and a lot of people feel general anxiety about, you know, pandemics. People just worry about the future. It's part of our nature to worry about the future, and people want to feel safe, and none of us really are ever safe, and something like the threat of nuclear war kind of really brings that home, you know. I meet an Indian author who's written quite a lot about climate change called Amitav Ghosh, and then he kind of says, well, what's interesting for me about all this is that it's not like I don't worry about the future either, because for people from my my part of the world, he comes from Bangladesh and India, and people from the colonized parts of the world, they've already been through their own destructive apocalypse, and now they're still alive, you know, and they still survive and they still thrive in many ways. And he says what he sees is basically this anxiety about the future is a kind of is just like our part of the world, the Western part of the world, realizing that it is losing its power. You know, like apparently in grief, like when psychologists talk about grief, there's a thing where if you've got a parent or a grandparent who is dying, and you know that they're going to die, people start to grieve in advance, you know, or especially if they have dementia, you can see them, like, their faculties shutting down one by one, and people who are watching their loved ones die like that, they go through this kind of pre-grief. And there are these therapists and psychoanalysts and psychologists who say that this is what a lot of people are feeling now about the earth itself, or about the society itself. They're feeling this kind of, they're going through this kind of pre-grief for something that is dying. But yeah, there's a nostalgia, there's a loss. We've lost our innocence, and in a weird way, they kind of want the apocalypse to happen so that we regain that innocence. You know, it's kind of it's a very Christian thing, isn't it? It's like we gave up paradise, so now we have to somehow get back to it through a major disaster. And that would be like a purge. It would be like Noah's flood, and then we would get back to our lost innocence. I think a lot of people would say that but probably that's not how it'll pan out, because, as you say, we will have certain technologies that we could probably still use for a while anyway. I mean, yeah, depends how long your generator's going to run. I mean, a lot of the preppers that I know are actually, even though they don't believe in climate change, or the ones that I met didn't, they actually hate the Green Party and the Green movement in general. They actually are quite ecologically better prepared than most people, because they have invested in solar panels, because they do think that the power grid is not sustainable. So they have invested in having in like local solar panels, which is this one guy I know in Cologne, he's extremely skeptical of the climate movement, but he does have, what do you call it, autonomous from the power grid. Mm-hmm. I think it would be like the idea that hope is treacherous. I think a lot of these people, look at the way that normal people, I'd say normal people, but everyone is, feels like that we have to, basically we everyone is like hoping that, you know, like Putin doesn't launch his nuclear weapons, or hoping that we prevent the worst excesses of climate change, or hoping that, that you know, society won't collapse and that we'll find some way, we'll keep it together in one way or another. And they see this hope as a delusional thing. And he said, and one guy, Guy McPherson, in fact, he said, I said to him, but surely because he wrote in one of his books, he wrote like, we should give up hope. Like, hope is this treacherous thing. And I said, but surely the opposite of hope is despair, you know, surely. He goes, no. He was like, he would have slapped his thigh if he could have done, but he was like, no, it's not the, why are you saying that? You know, that's not true at all. And then I said, okay, so what is the opposite of hope? And he said, I say the opposite of hope is taking action, is a sort of taking responsibility for your life, or trying to change something. If you really, really do worry about these things, if you are extremely anxious about the future, then hope isn't going to help you. What's going to help you is figuring out how you are going to deal with it and facing it. And I suppose that's what stuck with me, was this sort of this, and that can be practical. It can be like, you know, do what a prepper does and find a bunker in the forest and fill it with food, or it can be, you know, joining a climate protest or something. It can be like whatever you do. It can, or it can just be facing up to this, your general anxiety, and figuring out, okay, because we are all going to die. So what are you going to do with the time you have left? You know, what is valuable to you? And I think that is sort of the profound thing, is that you know, we should like this idea that. Yeah, this idea that it will all be okay in the end, is a treacherous idea, and that in fact it should be okay now, and all you can really control is this is how you cope with your life. What we're facing is, everybody goes, oh, we're all going to die, yeah. But then we are all going to die. Like, that's the one immutable fact of human existence, is that it will end, you know. And fully realizing that is, I think it's an Achilles in Homer. Doesn't he say everything is more beautiful because we're doomed, and the gods envy us for our mortality, you know, like, didn't he say something like that? For so sure. I think the idea of it is that, you know, we can, the everything is more beautiful because we're all going to die, you know, because of our mortality, and the gods envy us, the immortal gods envy us because of that. So I guess it's, so what I'm saying is that this sort of fear of the apocalypse is actually just a facing up to the sort of the human condition, in a very normal way, because, you know, yeah.
A man who has made a more specific, a metaphysical study of apocalypse, through how life should be lived at all times and in all places, is Orthodox rabbinical figure Chad Whitaker of Pittsburgh. I put him to the question in a dark cavern.
People are constantly bringing some sort of post-apocalyptic scenario to bear to, as like an exercise in like some sort of existential threat. And, okay. And perhaps the closer we get to feeling that there's some sort of accelerando in our lifetimes, it was wars in the past, and now obviously what we're looking at is...
Yeah, more wars, even like heightened. It is a crescendo? Maybe, but here's the thing. All right, so fundamentally, I don't know, right? Like, fundamentally, I don't know. Right. Like, logically, I can picture some scenarios. It's like, I can imagine an existential threat materializing. Like, I can imagine more easily now than last month, right? Like, a nuclear holocaust materializing, right? Or I can imagine an existential threat not materializing and universal paperclips and, like, you know, humanity expanding out into the galaxy or whatever, right? Like, you know, I can imagine Isaac Asimov, Last Story, sort of like cyclic, like, you know, the boom and bust and the, like, the on universal scales and, like, all of this, right? Like, anything logically imaginable is imaginable, okay? And God's outside of all of it, and God's doing whatever he wants, and there's these fundamental patterns of ordering, of hierarchy, of structure, you know, of structures of beauty, of these abstractions, of these hierarchical structures, like those are kind of circling back around to like this little apocalypse. Like, I really only need to care about what's in front of me. What's, like, what's in my sphere of influence, you know? Well, how about everything else? It's like, well, I don't know. I'm not everything else. Right. Like, I'm me, right. You know? Like, here's what I have to deal with right in front of me.
In terms of that existential threat, though, I think we're always presented with some extraordinarily grim, dark, bleak, like the road, or Nathan was talking about the stand earlier.
Yeah, right.
And I guess just like, what do we do in the face of that? What do we do, you know, rationally with a study of history, with a study of, you know, you have this theological framework.
But man, we had apocalypse in the last century. Like, look at Russia last century, you know? Like, look at the utter upheaval of mm-hmm. civilization and, like, you know, the Communist Revolution and Stalin. And yeah. The gulag, and like,
yeah,
you know, which is like reverberating through to our present day, right? Like this, like these tumultuous, yeah, you know, or the, like the Polish Jew, right? Like the, like Holocaust, like they're, like we witnessed in the 20th century, you know, almost as much apocalypse as one could want, let's say, you know, short of an existential crisis, short of an existential threat materializing. It's like these were, and then, but then what do individual people do in these, right? Like, there's a book called Father Arseny, there's a biography of this priest named Father Arseny, you know, who was an amazing saint in the gulag, and like kept the flame alive, you know, like it was like a real life. Well, you referenced the road, right? And like that's fiction, okay? Like keeping the light alive, like gotta keep the light alive. Like this guy kept the light alive in the gulag for decades, you know? And like, like when you're a person, you know, like
right.
When you're a person, like he couldn't he wasn't in control of the sweep of history, you know. He wasn't. he was a grain of sand in the ground in the wheels of history, right? And what? And he he did well with what he had, you know, and like, what more could any of us hope to do than to do well with what's God has given us in our sphere of influence, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Like, raise your son as well as you can. Love your neighbors as well as you can. You know, like, I don't want to do it out of fear. If I'm going to prepare for an apocalypse, like, there's, like, the apocalypse, choosing not to try to love God with all my heart, mind, soul, and strength. And I tasted choosing not to try, and that is what terrifies me. That's what terrifies me.
I am telling myself the story of my life, Stranger and Song of Fiction. We start with the joyful mysteries before the appearance of ether, trying to capture the elusive. The farm where the crippled horses heal, the woods where autumn is reversed, and the longing for bliss in the arms of some beloved from the past. I said, "Your daddy loves you." I said, "Your daddy loves you very much. He just doesn't want to live with us anymore."
You've been listening to Pandemonium. The opinions expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of WRCT or Carnegie Mellon University. Email comments or questions to WRCT Public Affairs, pa@wrct.org. Thanks for listening to WRCT Pittsburgh.
Young, yet this seems to me your ultimate mind. Blood fire, gun fire. Open features.
bitches about now. Devils and rebels squeezing my metal, I'm humming my cello. Cause they witch magics, they practice. Gangsters with knowledge.
Mom and Dad used to argue about everything, especially about Dad's drinking. My family went from totally crazy to quiet, calm, and even peaceful when Mom started going to Al-Anon family groups. I wanted a better relationship with Dad, so I asked Mom if she would take me to her Al-Anon meetings or to Al-Ateen. I'm sure glad I did. If someone's drinking troubling you, you might be surprised at what you can learn in an Al-Anon or Al-Ateen family group from people just like you. Call 1-888-4-ALANON or go to alanon.org.
You are listening to 88.3 FM WRCT, Pittsburgh.
The lights in the harbor don't shine for me. I'm like a lost ship adrift on the sea. Sea of heartbreak, lost love, loneliness, memories of your caress, so divine. I wish you were mine again, my dear. I'm on the sea of tears, sea of heartbreak. Heartbreak, lost love, loneliness, memories of your caress, so divine. How I wish you were mine again, my dear. I want to see your tears, see of a heartbreak.
Well, I love a rainy night, I love a rainy night. I love to hear the thunder, watch the lightning when it lights up the sky. You know it makes me feel good. Well, I love a rainy night, such a beautiful sight. I love to feel the rain on my face, taste the rain on my lips, in the moonlight shadows. Showers wash all my cares away.
I wake up to a sunny day, 'cause I love a rainy night. Yeah, I love a rainy night. Well, I love a rainy night. Well, I love a rainy night. Ooh, ooh. I love a rainy night. I love a rainy night. I love to hear the thunder, watch the lightning when it lights up the sky. You know it makes me feel good. Well, I love a rainy night. It's such a beautiful sight. I love to feel the rain on my face, taste the rain on my lips, in the moonlight shadows. Puts a song in this heart of mine, puts a smile on my face every time, 'cause I love a rainy night. Yeah, I love a rainy night. Ooh, I love a rainy night. Yeah, I love a rainy night. Ooh, ooh. Shadows wash all my cares away. Sunny day, 'cause I love a rainy night. Yeah, I love a rainy night. Well, I love a rainy night. I love a rainy night. Well, I love a rainy night. You can see it in my eyes. Yeah, I love a rainy night. Well, it makes me high. Ooh, I love a rainy night. No, I do. Yeah, yeah, I love a rainy night.
When we walk down the street, I feel a trembling in my knees. And just to know you're mine until the end of time makes my heart skip a beat. Well, I did a double take the day I met you. My heart turned to flip as I stood next to you. And I knew right there I never could forget you. For you are my every dream come true. And my heart skips a beat when we walk down the street. I feel a trembling in my knees. And just to know you're mine until the end of time makes my heart skip a beat. You came in. Turn my cloudy skies from gray to blue. You're my sunshine that comes up every morning. Yes, you are my every dream come true. And my heart skips a beat when we walk down the street. I feel a trembling in my knees. And just to know you're mine until the end of time makes my heart skip a beat.
One fine day as I was walking down the street, spied a beggar man with rags upon his feet. Took a penny from my pocket in his tin cup I did drop it, and I heard him say as I made my retreat, may the bird of paradise fly up your nose, may an elephant caress you with his toes, may your wife be plagued with runners in her hose. My laundry man is really on his toes. Found $100 bill among my clothes. When he called me, I came running, gave him back his dime for phoning, and I heard him saying as I turned to go, may the bird of paradise fly up your nose, may an elephant caress you with his toes, may your wife be plagued with runners in her hose, may the bird of paradise fly up your nose. I was way behind one day to catch a train. The taxi driver said, we'll make it just the same. A speed cop made it with us, and as he wrote out the ticket, I stood by politely waiting for my change. May the bird of paradise fly up your nose, may an elephant caress you with his toes, may your wife be plagued with runners in her hose, may the bird of paradise fly up your nose, may the bird of paradise fly up your nose, may an elephant caress you with his nose, may your wife be plagued with runners in her hose.
Pittsburgh are rolling down that eastern seaboard. I got my diesel wound up and she's a-running like I never before. There's a speed zone ahead with all right. I don't see a cop in sight. 6 days on the road and I'm gonna make it home tonight. I got me 10 forward gears on a Georgia overdrive. I'm taking little white pills and my eyes are open wide. I just passed a Jimmy in a white. I've been a-passing everything in sight. 6 days on the road and I'm a-gonna make it home tonight. But it seems like a month since I kissed my baby goodbye. I could have a lot of women, but I'm not a-like some of the guys. I could find one to hold me tight, but I could never make believe it's all right. 6 days on the road and I'm gonna make it home tonight. ICC is the checking on down the line. Well, I'm a little overweight and my logbook's way behind. But nothing bothers me tonight. I can dodge all the scales all right. 6 days on the road and I'm a-gonna make it home tonight. Well, my rig's a little old, but that don't mean she's slow. There's a flame from her stack and that smoke's a-blowing black as coal. My hometown's a-coming in sight. If you think I'm a-happy, you're right. 6 days on the road and I'm a-gonna make it home tonight. 6 days on the road and I'm a-gonna make it home tonight. 6 days on the road and I'm a-gonna make it home
down to Georgia. He was looking for a soul to steal. He was in a bind because he was way behind and he was willing to make a deal. When he came across this young man sawing on a fiddle and playing it hot, and the devil jumped up on a hickory stump and said, boy, let me tell you what. I guess you didn't know it, but I'm a fiddle player too. And if you'd care to take a dare, I'll make a bet with you. Now you play pretty good fiddle, boy, but give the devil his due. I bet a fiddle of gold against your soul, cause I think I'm better than you. The boy said, my name's Johnny, and it might be a sin, but I'll take your bet you're gonna regret, cause I'm the best as ever been. Johnny, rosin up your bow and play your fiddle hard, cause hell's broke loose in Georgia and the devil deals the cards. And if you win, you get this shiny fiddle made of gold, but if you lose, the devil gets your soul. Up his case and he said, I'll start this show. And fire flew from his fingertips as he rosined up his bow. And he pulled the bow across the strings and it made an evil hiss. And then a band of demons joined in and it sounded something like this. Finished, Johnny said, well, you're pretty good, old son, but sit down in that chair right there and let me show you how it's done. Fire on the mountain, run, boys, run. The devil's in the house of the rising sun. Chicken in the bread pan, picking out dough. Granny, let your dog bite, no child, no. The devil bowed his head because he knew that he'd been beat. And he laid that golden fiddle on the ground at Johnny's feet. Johnny said, devil, just come on back if you ever want to try again. I done told you once, you son of a bitch, I'm the best as ever been. He played, fire on the mountain, run, boys, run. Devil's in the house of the rising sun. The chicken in the bread pan, picking out dough. Granny, where your dog bite, no child, no.
Take this job and shove it. I ain't working here no more. A woman done left and took all the reason I was working for. You better not try to stand in my way as I'm walking out the door. Take this job and shove it. I ain't working here no more. Working in this factory for now 15 years. All this time I watched my woman drowning in a pool of tears. And I've seen a lot of good folk die, had a lot of bills to pay. I'd give the shirt right off of my back if I had the guts to say, take this job and shove it. I ain't working here no more. My woman done left and took all the reason I was working for. You better not try to stand in my way as I'm walking out the door. Take this job and shove it. I ain't working here no more. Well, that foreman, he's a regular dog. Line boss, he's a fool. Got a brand new flat top haircut. Lord, thinks he's cool. One of these days I'm gonna blow my top, and that sucker, he's gonna pay. Lord, I can't wait to see their faces when I get the nerve to say, take this job and shove it. I ain't worried.
here no more. A woman done left and took all the reason I was working for. You better not try to stand in my way as I'm walking out the door. Take this job and shove it. I ain't working here no more. Take this job and shove it. Country DJ's knows that I'm an outlaw. They'd never come to see me in this dive, where bikers stare at cowboys who are laughing at the hippies who are praying they'll get out of here alive. Loudmouth in the corner's getting to me, talking about my earrings and my hair. I guess he ain't read the signs that say I've been to prison. Someone ought to warn him before I knock him off his chair. Cause my long hair just can't cover up my redneck. I've won every fight I've ever fought, and I don't need some turkey telling me that I ain't country, saying I ain't worth a damn dough ticket that he bought. Cause I can sing all them songs about Texas, and I still do all the sad ones that I know. They tell me I look like Merle Haggard and sound a lot like David Allen Coe. And the barmaid in the last town that we played in knew the words to every song I'd wrote. She said Jimmy Rabbit turned her on to my last album just about the time the jukebox broke. Yeah, Johnny Cash helped me get out of prison long before Rodriguez stole that goat. I've been the Rhinestone Cowboy for so long I can't remember, and I can do you every song Hank Williams ever wrote. And I can sing all them songs about Texas, and I still do all the sad ones that I know. I can't help it, I look like Merle Haggard, and I sound a lot like David Allen Coe. But the country DJs all think I'm an outlaw, and they'd never come to see me dive, where bikers stare at cowboys who are laughing at the hippies who are praying they'll get out of here alive. The loudmouth in the corner's getting to me, talking about my earrings and my hair.
I wanna go home. I wanna go home. Oh, how I wanna go home. Last night I went to sleep in Detroit City, and I dreamed about those cotton fields and home. I dreamed about my mother, dear old papa, sister and brother. I dreamed about that girl who's been waiting for so long. I wanna go home. I wanna go home. Oh, how I want.
Home folks think I'm big in Detroit City. From the letters that I write, they think I'm fine. But by day I make the cards, by night I make the bars. If only they could read between the lines. 'Cause you know, I rode a freight train north to Detroit City. And after all these years, I find that I've just been wasting my time. So I just think I'll take my foolish pride and put it on a southbound freight and ride. Go on back to the loved ones, the ones that I left waiting so far behind. I wanna go home. I wanna go home. Oh, I want to go home.
On the road again. Just can't wait to get on the road again. The life I love is making music with my friends. I can't wait to get on the road again. On the road again. Going places that I've never been. Seeing things that I may never see again. I can't wait to get on the road again. On the road again.
You are listening to WRCT 88.3 in Pittsburgh, and this is From Ipanema to the World. Thank you. And welcome to From Ipanema to the World. I am Flavio Chamis, and tonight we bring a star of the Brazilian guitar world. He has been in Pittsburgh a number of times, but also played in more than 60 countries around the world. Despite being relatively young, he has dozens of CDs, DVDs, and is the winner of several important music competitions, including the Montreux Jazz. Diego amazes his audiences not only with his exceptional technique,